Good morning and welcome. Our meeting this morning, of course, is about this special day itself, Easter. But before we proceed with that, we will give the announcements. On Wednesday evenings, from 5:15 to 7:15, we have a library, a reference library, that is open for your use. And then at 7:30 to 8:30, we have a study class. We are studying William Q. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy, a synthesis, we could say, of the secret doctrine, which is rather incredible if you were to hold the two books together. The genius of the secret doctrine is known to the world. The genius of Mr. Judge synthesizing it in that manner is not known to the world and should be. On Sunday mornings from 11 to 12, we have a series of talks and discussions on particular aspects of the philosophy. For this month of April, it's been the lives and legends of the saviors. And this coming Sunday will be Buddha, the light of Asia. On Wednesday, our umbrella topic will change and will be psychism and spirituality. The meetings on Sunday open at 10:30 and are from 11 to 12, with ample time for questions. Just a reminder, May 8th, we have a special meeting coming up and a commemoration of the life and work of Madam H.P. Blavatsky. The policy of any and every United Lodge of Theosophy is always printed on the back of the periodical. But because we start not seeing things we're used to, unless we have the declaration to read or to present, we might not be listening every time we hear it, which is a shame because it is a very occult and very spiritual declaration of policy. First, it tells us it is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Now, that is said not just of each United Lodge, but each individual who is an associate of that lodge. It is independent devotion. No one tells us what to read, how to study, how to behave, how to think, except ourselves. It is self-induced and self-devised, and it is based on the aim, purpose, and teaching that we learn in the studies of theosophy. And that is also how fellow students are recognized. There's no consideration of gender or condition or affiliation, of race or creed. It is an understanding that it is the self in all, that it is pure unity. We are one in our essence, and it is a recognition of that, ignoring all the rest of it to the best of our ability. And because of that, and this is why we think it's so amazing, there is no constitution, no bylaws, no officers, and yet it continues. Since 1909, this idea, without a foundation that almost every other group has, continues. It lives and it grows. And another consideration of this policy is that it shows what we're about as an individual. And if anyone questions you, why do you put so much time and effort into all of this? You can talk about the spiritual ideas, but you can also point to this, that you are part of an independent devotion for the service of humanity. So we think it's always a good idea to read and reread that. Now this morning, our subject, of course, is Easter, but it's the symbolism and meaning of Easter. So we will have the talk presented and then time for questions and discussion.
Life laughs in bud and bloom from out the bough. 'Tis Easter now. The sun his golden journey makes in wide circles across the sky. O radiance, teach us how to mirror in our eyes the gleam, to let shine forth the light we dream. This Easter now. Today, April 21st, we celebrate Easter, a day full of tradition when we hunt for colored eggs, exchange colored eggs, and even in some parts of the world, give colored eggs as gifts. Isn't it always interesting to discover that many of the customs or festivals that we observe in this day and age, without knowing the reason for their observance, have come down to us from races and civilizations long since dead. It gives us a strange feeling to find that there is indeed nothing new under the sun, and that what we are doing today, other people in other lands did in other times. It makes us realize that if anything is of true importance to men, it must be universal in its expression, whether it be a custom or the celebration of a festival. In this sense, the celebration of Easter, with the ceremonies that go with it, is a universal festival and consequently gains in its importance because of this fact. We wonder if we realize that we are actually taking part in or participating in an ancient sacred festival centuries older than the modern Christian celebration, which, by the way, began in the 4th century, 325 to be more exact. We wonder if they know that this sacred festival is actually a physical event, a day set apart to do certain physical acts, such as feasting or fasting or giving alms or listening to discourses or reading sacred texts, a day fixed by the great teachers of the ancient world out of their profound knowledge of astronomy and its soul, astrology. If we look back into the night of time, we find that the hunting of eggs on a certain day in the spring of the year was customary in many centuries long before Christian days, and that it symbolized the resurrection, the new birth, which took place in nature in the spring. We see the ancient Babylonians worshipping the egg, which was hatched from the goddess Ishtar, in the same way that we find the ancient Egyptians paying homage to the egg, which came from the mouth of the unmade and eternal deity Kenneth. We find in Scandinavia the worship of the pagan goddess of the spring, Ostara, or Estre. And we read tales of the old Norsemen exchanging colored eggs on this certain spring day in commemoration of the goddess. even among the Hindus, we find the idea that the mundane egg in which Brahma was gestated broke its shell in the spring. So we see that the egg is an ancient symbol with a universal meaning. During Easter, Christendom observes two events: the crucifixion of Jesus and his resurrection. According to legend, he was crucified on a Friday, and he arose from the dead the following Sunday. Easter, therefore, must represent both death and life. The death of Jesus of Nazareth, his burial, the disappearance of his body, and the subsequent appearance in his physical body to his followers, ending with his ascension in body to heaven, has given the idea that at the last judgment, the dead will be revitalized and the good, or the believers, will be taken to heaven to remain there forever. And the wicked, or the non-believers, will be condemned to eternal punishment in hell. If we look at the story of death and resurrection, we find that it is a gross caricature of very old and ancient initiation ceremonies practiced by the Egyptians and other civilizations. In these ceremonies, which took place in caves, crypts, temples, the pyramids, and elsewhere, the neophyte underwent a series of physical and psychological trials through which he proved his strength and readiness for spiritual rebirth. It was through these trials that strength can be gauged and full control attained by the inner immortal entity over the personality and over nature's forces. Apart from the idea of resurrection and the second birth, this spring festival shows us how death is always followed by life, and spring follows winter in never-ending succession. The seed sacrifices itself in order that the plant may grow. The plant life produces the flower, which has to die if the fruit is to follow. And within the fruit is the seed for perpetual immortality. Slowly but surely, the idea must take root in men's mind that death is an important stage which marks the destruction of form and the regeneration of spirit in a better form. The practical value for us of this idea is that it shows that there is in us an entity who can enter, leave, and re-enter the body. That in fact we are twofold beings: the outer body of the flesh, the inner is the Christ. All evolution is for the purpose of bringing to birth in matter form the Christ within. Therefore, it is possible for us to be resurrected. This body personality that we prize and nurture is but the sepulcher which hides the glory of Christ. The door is closed by the stone of matter, which prevents the Christ spirit from manifesting itself, and the passions crucify the Christ. Revelations 3:20 in the Christian Bible says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." This refers, of course, to the Christ being locked out of our heart. So Easter is about bringing forth or resurrecting the Christ within us. To do this, we need to work on cleansing the temple of the personality. while remaining conscious all the time of this duality within us. And from the 19th century poet, Matthew Arnold, the seeds of godlike power are in us still. Gods are we, bards, saints, heroes, if you will. Once again, the title of today's topic, Easter, its symbolism and meaning.
As we all know, The Secret Doctrine is a huge book. But if you go to the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, you'll find that symbolism takes up over 170 pages of volume one. So symbolism is obviously very important to the expression of occultism, but equally important for us to learn, to understand, to recognize it, even in the simplest of things. So have you thought about Easter and what you know as the symbolisms? Yes.
We're always curious about the bunny.
Well, first, that's a misnomer. It was the hare, H-A-R-E. And if you've ever seen a picture of the hare, it's about five times the size of a bunny. You wouldn't want to meet one and cuddle with it. They're big creatures. But they're also very mysterious. It is the male hare that nurtures the young. That's a mystery right there, and would make you do some reviewing about androgynous hermaphrodites, which we are told was a natural thing in the beginning, and then the separation into two distinct sexes. The hare represents, of course, the prolificness of nature, but it also represents something higher and much more spiritual. We encourage you all to research it and see what you make of it. You had your hand up?
The symbolism of the cross, and we came across Krishna, he wasn't on a cross, but he was an arrow was shot through him, and he was on a tree. What is that symbolism about?
The cross, the symbolism of the cross? And think how it mystified the Spanish when they arrived in South America. And they found crosses thousands of years old. And do you know what they came up with as an answer? Why the cross was sacred in South America? Well, it's a brilliant sort of, I don't know what to call the word. I don't want to say diabolical, but it's a twist on thinking and logic. Yes.
Was that plagiarism by anticipation?
Well, yes. The statement given out was that the devil, in order to confound the spiritual and the religious, had this idea given to the early South American culture so they could build these crosses and confound everybody later. So it had nothing to do with anything spiritual to anybody else. It was just the work of the devil. And they kept coming across these things. But oddly enough, even though it was considered the work of the devil, they tore them from where they were and put them into their own churches because they were solid gold. Solid gold was never treasured by early cultures as anything but a way to depict the spiritual and the permanent. It wasn't considered money or financial. It was respectful and spiritual. But the cross, if you go back even earlier into Egypt and India, you discover it was the symbol for initiation, something that every individual is working towards. And in, is it pronounced Cheops or the pyramid? Cheops or
Cheops?
Cheops. It, that sounds pretty silly, as gorgeous as that place is. They, the archaeologists didn't know what to make of this, what looked like a corn bin or something. And in the secret doctrine, we're told that it was the place of initiation, and that the candidate would be tied to a cruciform, a cross, placement, and left for 3 days. And if he conquered the challenges, he would stand forward and adept. If he did not, he would die. And this was an effort at being able to conquer the things that stood in your way before you could get this complete wisdom for that period. So it was ancient and well known that it represented something far above the ordinary, something very spiritual. So the death on the cross was the releasing of all of the physical, the personal, the selfish, and taking the position of your real inner spiritual being. It wasn't the death of an individual as a sort of punishment. Interestingly enough, and we don't know how many Christians have ever, there is a book called Pagan and Christian Creeds, which was written by Edward Carpenter, and it was published in the 50s, we think. His statement in there is, there was not enough time for the various things to have taken place between Friday and Sunday. It could not have happened. And he listed from the night before to the crucifixion, this is what's supposed to have happened: the Last Supper, the agony in the garden, the betrayal of Judas, Christ brought before Caiaphas, brought before the Sanhedrin, brought before Pilate in the middle of the night, a visit to Herod, scourging and mocking, the journey to Golgotha, and the crucifixion at sunrise. It could not have happened. And it didn't happen, as Theosophy says. It's the depiction of the cycle of initiation, and was said of every great wise man, every great sage and seer, that they had to go through these various steps, these various challenges, in order to stand forth with wisdom. So the cross and the crucifixion do not mean what we think they mean. And we are instructed, as was said in the talk, that we crucify the Christ in ourselves when we go against that true essence of spirituality. So it's far more ancient than what the Christians think, and it is not what they use it for. So, yes.
Well, India has a, they found in many of the burial places.
Speak up a little.
They found in many burial places this depiction of a cross and a being crucified on it. And they had, they called it, was God Witoba, was, you know, and that was depicted in a very ancient structure.
Mm-hmm. And we're not familiar with that one, but we know that throughout the whole of Earth, you will find those reminiscences, those memories. We all, at the point of the Well, no, we think we have to go back a little. The fact is that we, as spiritual beings, as thinkers, are eager to come here in the process of our own initiation, but also to elevate the life in the lower kingdoms. And in the process, the kingdoms have to be built up. There has to be a human form for us to incarnate into. And when we first do, it must be a very difficult time. That spiritual consciousness being restricted into one little limited dual mind with the capacity to go high or low. And it must be quite a struggle and challenge. And since this is recognized, in that beginning of that mixture of the thinker with the form, elder brothers are here instructing in the arts and the sciences and teaching us all that we need to know, including festivals and commemorations, and why altruism, why have periods and cycles, and what the meaning is of the equinoxes and the solstices. So we had this all as a knowledge and a background and a memory. It's all part of our intrinsic awareness that we keep away from ourselves by following rites or rituals or dogmas, or by going in the opposite direction and being totally materialistic. But it is all there. And once an individual begins looking into it, more and more comes to their awareness. So these traditions of all of the various saviors going through the same identical experiences, and they're expressed in a way that is allegorical or metaphorical. So we don't take them literally, but we understand that they're trying to tell us a grand story, not just about that individual, but about the potential for ourselves. And we've always thought the most profound statement about that fact was when the Buddha said, "Look within, thou art Buddha. You're just waiting. You just have to come to the awareness that you are that." Yes?
Well, the Christian church has pretty much always claimed that they're unique.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these myths and legends and traditions and history. So that's what we were referring to earlier. They claim it was plagiarism by anticipation, and that the devil was involved in that too.
Right.
It's like, if you can't explain something, it's the devil. It's the boogeyman. So, we were wondering too if what the difference would be between symbolism and fetishism, because this burning of the terrible fire in Notre Dame. And they claim they went in and they saved the crown of thorns. And all these other churches also have parts of it, parts of the cross, nails of the cross. It's you don't mock somebody for their beliefs. But
you do have to wonder if they believe it.
Yeah, you really do. And it just seems like, come on.
Well, we think back in earlier days, it was easier to keep people believing it because they wanted to and because their experience was very limited. You keep people stupid enough and they will believe what they're told. But we don't think in today's day and age that people necessarily believe that those things are genuine. But you can have something as a symbol, whether it's a cross or we've all seen the Om symbol, whatever it is, you can use it as a way to remind yourself of the reality behind the symbol. So you're not worshiping the symbol. You're not making a fetish of it. It's the meaning that's behind it. And that can't harm anyone. But to believe and put your faith, well, now, see, there's another strange thing. We're spiritual beings, and because we are, when we put our faith in something, we can make it work because we believe it so totally with our own power. So we have placebos, which still mystify medicine, because many placebos work better than the medicines that they have developed to treat the very same thing. So if we put our faith in something, it can manifest. But sooner or later, we will be betrayed by it because it is not real. So we have to watch what we put our faith in so we don't get bitter and start searching in the wrong place. Yes?
Well, we disagree that people don't believe that they're real. We know educated people who believe that they're real. They're educated, they're not ignorant, they're literate, highly educated, but yet they, when it comes to faith, it defies logic often. So, and of course there's many ignorant people that don't know any better. It's still pretty commonly believed that these objects are the real thing and have power. But look at all the relics of the saints and the
I never have, so okay. I don't know.
We can go up to Fifth and Girard and look at St. John Newman's body under the altar there if you like.
I thought they moved it. I thought it was taken somewhere else.
Well, that was his church, so.
I know. That I have
and
seen.
He was a wonderful man. He did a lot of, an awful lot of good. We're not, you know.
Well, let's talk about Francis of Assisi.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Because we're saying some of these things, we're not saying that Christians are not spiritual.
Right.
Or on the way to initiation. We can't know that. Each individual is their own priest and their own judge. But we are saying that there is an attempt many times to control and to lead people to think and to agree in a certain way. And that's the complete opposite of what we are taught, that it is individual devotion, that you have to perfect yourself, you have to clean up your thinking, your feeling, you have to devote yourself to becoming Christ-like. Now, there are many within the church that do that sincerely. As you say, you know those who believe that these relics are real. We know some Christians who believe that their life should be led in a Christ-like fashion, that they give of all they have to help life, regardless of the creed or the color or anything else of the individual they're trying to help. So it is a huge question whether someone believes or not. But what it comes down to is how do we act on the basis of what we believe? You could be a better theosophist being a true Christian than a theosophist who is merely studying and reading and repeating words. So we can't really judge individuals except ourselves. And that we should do perhaps more harshly than we do anyone else. I'm sure many of you are aware that there was also, on the same day as the Notre Dame fire, a mosque that burned. Very strange times. Well, nobody wants to talk about the egg, obviously. Maybe enough was said about it. The egg was incorporated as a sacred sign in the cosmogony of every people on the earth and was revered both on account of its form and its inner mystery. From the earliest mental conceptions of man, it was known as that which represented most successfully the origin and secret of being. The gradual development of the imperceptible germ within the closed shell. The inward working without any apparent outward interference of force, which from a latent nothing produced an active something, needing naught save heat, and which, having gradually evolved into a concrete living creature, broke its shell, appearing to the outward senses of all a self-generated and self-created being, must have been a standing miracle from the beginning. We don't know how many of you have been watching some of the births of eagles and owls. We can't think of the channel that runs it, but you are at the nest and you are watching the shells being broken open. And then it's unbelievable how clumsy the parents are. You don't understand how these chicks live. I mean, because they get bumped around and sat upon, and it's truly scary. But if you stop and think about an egg, the next time you go to hold one in your hand, think about it. Think how that liquid mixture inside lives through all that handling. How is that possible? It is the very shape that keeps it from breaking and harming what's inside. But how about you think about what they mean? What is the shell, do you think? If we're going to talk about symbology, what would the shell represent in an egg? Yes?
Protection.
Pardon?
Protection.
Protection, yes. But we were thought relating it to what we know as physical things. Yes?
Well, to the chick, the egg is a karmic limitation, not letting the chick do what it might otherwise do were it not for the presence until the chick is ready to break out of the egg.
Mm-hmm. It is a protection and a limitation, yes.
It needs to overcome.
But if it weren't there, it couldn't overcome anything.
Well, it would be dead.
Yeah.
But
yes.
The shell, because we know that if the chick is trying to come out, and say a human picks the shell part, and the chick could die.
Yes. The same with a butterfly.
Because it needs to have the shell. And it's working, and it's building muscles.
Exactly.
And so it's an obstacle that it has to overcome in order to grow.
In other words, it's the gymnasium for part of that growth. But we were thinking, I think you're all very lofty, we were thinking very earthy. The shell would represent the sky. It's enclosed the whole of that process, then what would the inner of the egg be? All right, let's go to the yolk. What would the yolk be? Yes. Well, yeah, it's the germ of what develops. It contains all of the physical qualities, but if we were doing it the way we wanted to do it, and you're all so smart, you're not cooperating, the yolk would represent the earth, and the white would represent the feelings, the astral, the liquid. So you have the solid earth, the liquid, and the encasement of the whole thing. So that's what we were thinking of. We were being very limited. The egg as a spiritual symbol, of course, was sacred, and an understanding that all of the globes that we see are like the mundane egg. So we're sorry we brought it up. Now, we would like to make another effort. What about the lily? Well, the church uses the lily. The ancients use the lotus. What about the stages of the lotus? You don't like that either. Yes.
Well, isn't there the idea that the roots of the lotus are in the water and in the mud? But then when it comes up, it's this gorgeous flower. So it's like the blossoming of the higher self.
Yes.
You know, from the human form and the lower nature being transposed into the
It's the form. Very same thing about the egg. The roots are in the mud, earth. The inner, the stem, is in what?
Water.
Liquid.
Astral.
Exactly. It's the exact same thing. It is the egg. It's earth, water, and then the sky. And that flower blooms in the open air. It has nothing to do with the mud or the water, but it is what brought it there. Now that's symbolical of us. Our roots are in the mud because we're in this form. We are supposed to be in this form because that is the gymnasium, that is the school, that is where we learn all of the things that make us realize that we are not this, that we are spiritual using this, even though most of the time it seems to be the other way around. The material or physical or selfish or personal is using the higher mind or putting it to sleep so that it can do what it wants, but we made it so. Yes.
Isn't the rose also used as a substitute
Yes.
for the lotus
Yes.
in the West here?
And we have then the Rosicrucians. It's the symbology of all of these things are connected together. You take any one thing and it represents all of the stages of all of the others. And that's what makes symbology such a fascinating study. We promise you, if you start reading the parts in SD1, it starts on page 303 on symbology, you're going to have people send out for food for you, because you're not going to want to leave it, because your mind gets so activated at making connections that you didn't even know you already had within yourself for the symbolism of things. Because we see more and hear more and feel more than we let ourselves know, which is why we have to dream usually. So we have the lower nature, the higher nature, and how they meet in the mind of man, of human. And it's symbolism that gives us, I don't know, kind of the key to open some of these doors we have closed in ourselves. So it's a great study, and we encourage everyone to do it, because it's not only a great study, it's a pleasurable study, because it awakens things within you. And it has to, because we are all spiritual. We're all from one and the same source. Now, what about the names of all these goddesses? Did it strike you at all? Astarte, Astar, Astarte. They all relate to stars, and yes.
They all relate to Easter. They all.
And that's the way the name Easter came from, right? They're all goddesses. Estrogen. The things we don't think about. And yet these things are all there from ancient times, trying to tell us. It's awesome. Do you know who started the Easter tradition for the Catholic Church? Constantine at the Nicene, how do you say it? Is that how you say it? Council in 325. So obviously Easter wasn't Easter before 325. And yet we wonder how many Christians know that. Just as December 25th was not chosen as the birth of Christ until it was decided, well, let's do it when all the pagans are doing their solstice celebration. And then, you know, and of course, it's believed that those are the actual dates. Yes. Wait, I didn't hear that. Because what?
Because we know that there was the discrepancy of when Christ was born.
Mm-hmm.
So is this time of year for Easter, is this like, is there questions as to did he really die and resurrect at this time of year?
Well, who do you mean asking the questions? Who's questioning that? The church? We don't think Christians question that. Most of them don't even know. It wasn't until 325 that it was decided.
Because it's just kind of interesting that the whole idea of resurrection and springtime is like the resurrection of...
But that's the why of it. That's if we go back to the beginning, when as thinkers, we incarnated into these human forms. Those are some of the things that we were taught, that at certain cycles, you will see the repetition and the equinox, when the day and the night are equal. The spring equinox brings, as you said, resurrection. You move from winter into spring, into life again. However, in the other hemisphere, it's the autumnal equinox that is used, because that's when they move from winter. These things were established for a reason, and that must be why Constantine was wise enough to pick the vernal equinox as the Easter celebration, and even to take the name Easter, reflecting the history of what was known throughout the lands as what happens in the springtime. So it isn't strange. The point is that Jesus did not get crucified and resurrected within that time frame. And according to theosophy, there was no teacher of that name at that time who was crucified. And it points back to an earlier teacher who did the very things that were said of Jesus. So that's a study in itself. But the fact that the equinox is used in this way is that we were taught to have it this way, so that we would be reminded there is a cycle of rebirth, of the fact that we crucify the spiritual in ourselves, and we must work to find that point within ourselves in which to live the higher spiritual life. And then we are resurrected, and then we become the helpers of those wise ones who instructed us to begin with. If you're interested, the traditions of Osiris, Adana, Krishna, there's all the same sort of legends and myths that relate to the Christ. Yes.
So, in the grand picture of things.
Pardon?
In the grand picture of the earth, that from the winter solstice to the vernal equinox, it's said that the earth is very, the word is...
well, at Christmas, young, the astral light is young and strong.
Young and strong, and that spring, everything is reborn.
Right.
So it's really an indication for our own nature to, as we get with the cycle, we are reborn. We have that, you know, and if we follow the cycle, we are invigorated.
Yes.
In the sun.
The sap is rising.
Yeah.
We are told that when you make your resolutions at the winter solstice, that all of the energy of life is behind you to keep those resolutions, if you're making sincere ones, and telling yourself to will to do something, that you will see the fruits of that as the spring develops. It doesn't mean you have to have kept to it the whole time, and therefore you should make fewer resolutions so that you will keep to it. And the strongest warning is, do not make negative resolutions. Don't decide to not do something, because every time you think of your resolution, you're thinking of what you shouldn't do. Make positive ones. Let's see, we had some more here on... but it's also just on the egg. Yes?
But isn't it rather ironic that the church destroyed as much as they possibly could of remnants of the ancient religions and symbolism, and here we have, they preserved it all for humanity. They called it their own, but really these are an amalgamation of all these ancient symbols.
Well, the problem is if you turn a reality which is to be used into a dogma which is to be held up and just believed in, then you kill the vitality of it. In many ways, that's exactly what medicine often does. It's that it takes something that is beneficial to the human body and then compounds it in such a way that all of the vitality is now gone from it, which is what made the thing work in the first place. So we're very funny creatures, we humans. Sincere usually, but pretty funny and clumsy. And religion doesn't help us overcome that, because it doesn't tell us you have to do this. It says believe this, follow this. It doesn't say you have to learn and grow. A number of years ago, we did a sort of study on Lent, trying to understand its basis and the actual original meaning of Lent was, there is something in your way that is preventing you from being all you could be in a spiritual sense. Therefore, give it up. Give up that one thing. See if you can do it. That's exactly right. But it went from there to chocolate or Coca-Cola or coffee or whatever. Give up these things. But it was never meant to be to release a thing, but to release a habit, release a fault of thinking or behaving, because it was in your way. Now that's philosophical, and that's very different. So the church, perhaps for some individuals, it does good. But for the basic human, it does not, because it makes you dependent and never, never gives you the idea that you already have everything you need within you to do the whole thing. You do not need a priest. You do not need a church. You need wisdom. You need to know some true ideas about yourself and about life. And obviously, we're headed in that direction. You do recall in our study of cycles what follows the cycle of the Iron Age. What's the next cycle?
The Golden Age.
The Golden Age. That's amazing, isn't it? Well, when you think about it, what is the Iron Age but this big effort and this big struggle to get somewhere? So we should see the results individually, and then if enough of us have done it, collectively for humanity, in the Golden Age. We'll begin to enjoy or use or practice what we've been training for. Yes.
Associated with these, because we don't like purple.
We think purple's kind of modern, perhaps, but certainly red. In most of the ancient cultures, eggs were colored red, which is blood, which is life, which is, you know, the energy behind, or fire. It's considered fire as well. But we're sure that the colors are very meaningful. And we would hope that you do research on it, and at next year's Easter talk, give us a little dialogue on purple. Purple, of course, is the color of royalty, and no one else was allowed to wear it. Well, if you don't have... Oh, wait, behind you.
So what would it be then with these billions of people who participate in these religions all around the world, who teach false ideas, who hold up certain symbols that have lost their meaning?
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the masses of people that they put themselves into this place of ignorance? Why are people born into this? They're not victims.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're victims, they're victims of their own past.
You know, we can all look backwards and see we were born into a particular religion. And what does that tell us about ourselves? We think people are sometimes afraid to question. We have seen devout people come in here, question, appreciate the answers, and run scared. Literally afraid. If I do that, I may lose all that I have. And they don't want to make the effort. But because they had that glimmer or a seed, in a life or two, they're going to have to do it. But the fear that orthodoxy generates in people is the fear that says, I don't want to risk anything because I might lose what I have, and how do I know this is true or this is right? So we follow in the steps of our predecessors, our family. Yes.
Well, we always thought that the root of the problem of humanity is that we're looking outside of ourselves for the solutions in life. So we're all looking for an outside God.
A savior, right.
A savior. Looking, and why the Eastern religions talk about the savior lies within.
And, right.
So we must take responsibility, and therefore.
Well, you know, it is in the Christian Bible. There are many things in the Christian Bible that will give you pause. And one is where Christ is said to have screamed at the crowd. Do you know what he screamed? Heal yourselves. What could be more powerful than that? How could I have the power to heal myself? You're the Savior. And he's saying, no, you save yourself. And then the soul that touched the garment of Christ and said, it healed me. And he said, no. You healed yourself. You believed in that. You grabbed that. You touched that. And you healed. You healed yourself. We all have that within us. It's from the words of a student. Man is essentially divine, a universal being on a mission through matter to gain knowledge and to aid the evolution of lesser intelligence. When he acts for himself, he crucifies the harmony of life. When he acts for the good of all, he is beginning his resurrection to knowledge and power. Happy Easter to all of us and to all the world.